The Guardian.
This podcast is sponsored by audible.co.uk, the number one online destination for digital audiobooks.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hallo.
Aus dem Kaiserreich wird eine Republik.
Alles führt das Volk, alles durch das Volk. Es lebe das Neue, es lebe die Deutsche Republik.
Hindenburg zur Kriegsschuldfrage.
Dass Deutschland schuld sei an diesem größten aller Kriege.
Warum waren aber diese Notmaßnahmen nicht mit dem Reichstag zu verwirklichen? Keine Partei des letzten Reichstags ist mir bekannt.
This is an extract from chapter 6. Die Stadt war so groß und Emil war so klein. Und kein
Emil felt very small among them all in that big busy city. Nobody cared about his having no money or that he didn't know where he was going. There were 4 million people in Berlin at that moment and not one of them cared what was happening to Emil Tischbein. No one has time for other people's troubles in a city. They've all troubles enough of their own. They may listen for a moment and perhaps say how sorry they are. But they're probably thinking, oh, for goodness sake, don't bother me about it. It was awful to feel so alone, and Emil wondered what would happen to him.
Hallo, kleines Fräulein, darf ich Sie begleiten? Hallo.
Do you recognise that book? Does the Oompa Jazz help? It's a children's classic that has never been out of print since it was published in 1929. Set in Berlin, Emil und die Detektive, excuse my German, or Emil and the Detectives, is a favourite of children's writer Michael Rosen, who you heard reading there. Michael is guest director of this year's Brighton Festival and has chosen this book for Young City Reads, a two-month project involving children, parents, schools and libraries all over Brighton. It kicked off at this week's World Book Night and will culminate with a special Emil event at the festival in late May. In case you don't already know it,
Emil is sent from his small German town to see his granny in Berlin but has his spending money stolen on the train. He tracks a thief from the station across the city to a hotel. His luck turns when a group of city boys decide to help him in his effort to get the money back. They trap the thief, get the police along who accept their story. It then turns out the same crook is responsible for a bank robbery and Emil gets a fat reward as well.
As Michael has written, it was a groundbreaking children's book about child detectives. It also gives us a revealing view of children and the life of pre-Hitlerian Germany. So the Brighton Festival decided to send Michael for a day trip to follow the book around Berlin, where he met up with our own correspondent, Kate Connolly.
Ausstieg links.
Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Kate Connolly from The Guardian.
Hello, Kate. Hello. How'd you do? Well, you find us in a cafe. This feels very Emil-like, doesn't it?
We're at Zoologischer Garten, or it's probably called Zoo Station in the English version of the book. This is where Emil got off the train.
He gets off one stop early. How could he have done it? You think he's coming from the country and he's never been to the big city before and he gets off one stop early. I mean, I remember that being read to us when I was a child and thinking, how could he? I mean, I lived in the suburbs and there was the idea that when you went up to town it was a little bit like what Emil does, and even that seemed risky. And we get on the Metropolitan line, the idea that you'd get off, say, I don't know, at Finchley Road before Baker Street, I mean, that would be just so scary, you just wouldn't know where you were. So with the spirit of Kessner, we're entitled to eat the cherry cake.
And there's a lot of cafes in the book, aren't there? There's a lot of the action takes place in cafes.
Yes.
Because, of course, at that time they were... Cafe culture was very, yeah, very strong in Berlin, much stronger than it is now.
I remember that, you know, even in East Germany when I came here, I remember thinking, why are those people standing over there and they're having something to drink and they're eating Well, I didn't even know the word hot dog in those days.
When were you last here, and indeed, I think, first here?
1957, yes. I don't think I've been back to Berlin since, or where we were staying, which is Weimar. So this was a communist teachers' delegation. A woman called Dorothy Diamond organised teachers' delegations to East Germany throughout the 50s. The idea was to bring the good news from East Germany to teachers and everybody else, because there was so much bad press about communist Germany. She and these other teachers, they were really, I think they were supposed to be kind of pioneers almost in telling the story of how marvellous East Germany was.
So maybe we can allude to your journey as we take a trip now through Berlin. But it's interesting that you were a very similar age to Emil when you came here.
You know, my knowledge of Germany was coloured by two main things. One was Emil, but also that my dad had been here in the American Army of Occupation in Berlin, and he often told us stories, and he had photographs. He had a huge pile of photographs he had taken, beginning of 1946 through to 47. Amazing and extraordinary, because it was like, obviously, bombed out London, but also with American troops walking around, and also occasionally had pictures of Russian troops. And also he took pictures of some of the first peace demonstrations that took place, which were then banned, because all street demonstrations were banned soon after. So we're going to get on here. So we're doing the opposite of what Emil did. We're getting on the train at Zoological Gardens, and he got one.
That's right. This is the S-Bahn. The S-Bahn hasn't changed all that much. Of course, the route's the same.
Yes.
It's actually quite a good way to see the city, because it goes over ground.
Yeah, I like that.
You can look through the windows.
So you have S-Bahn and U-Bahn.
Yeah, more or less unten. Except if you're in a poor district, then they built them overground, because they couldn't afford to build them underground. And that, it's also mentioned in the book.
Yes. Yeah. And they're waiting at Friedrichstrasse station. Grandmother is waiting, isn't she, with Pony Hütchen.
With her bike.
With her brand new flashy bike that she's very fond of. Oh, we're at Friedrichstrasse. Granny and Pony are waiting for us.
At the flower store.
At the flower store, yes. And he's got a bunch of flowers, but he isn't coming. We're doing what he didn't do. He's off on the 177 tram, tailing Grundeis. Right, so Ausgang Friedrichstrasse. The wonderful thing about the book is that there are not only the characters of all the people, but actually Berlin itself is a character in the book. And Kästner, he must have read some of the things that people were saying about the city, because there were theorists of the city, somebody like Georg Simmel, who wrote about something called Straßenrausch, street noise, and that this was what cities were and this is how people lived. There were people thinking this is a newish way of living in these big cities with all this machinery and so on. And quite often in the book you come across these pieces where he's almost explaining what life is like in the city. He's using the fact that Emile is an innocent, if you like, idiot savant in the French phrase, the knowing innocent, going there so that he can explain it inside a newspaper office. It's all bustle and people are running to and fro. And here he is, that when Emile first arrives, right here in Friedrichstrasse, in English it goes, motor cars rushed past with horns honking and screeching brakes. They signalled right-hand turns and left-hand turns and swung off down side streets while other cars came swooping up behind them. The noise was indescribable, and on the pavements crowds of people kept hurrying by. Out of every turning, vans and lorries, trams and double-decker buses swarmed into the main thoroughfare. There were newspaper stands at every corner with men shouting the latest headlines. Wherever Emil looked, there were gay shop windows filled with flowers and fruit, books, clothes, fine silk underwear, gold watches and clocks, and all the buildings stretched up and up into the sky. So
This was Berlin. The sheer positive excitement of the city is so out of kilter with how people were writing about the city for children at that time. The city was the den of iniquity. Everything bad went on in the city. Noise was bad. It was full of rogues and ne'er-do-wells. And in a sense, obviously, there is a ne'er-do-well, but the children overcome it. They're not defeated by it. And also, you know, in the traditional late Victorian novel, which is not all that long before this, you know, a drunkard had to die, possibly a child had to die in order then to be redeemed. The redemption comes from the fact that 100 boys and Pony Hootchin overcome the badness. So it's completely reversing what was the stereotype for the city and a children's book at that time. You get the impression that maybe Emil will come to stay in Berlin. You were just within the context of this book, but it's been so exciting that he dearly loves his mum and he'll do anything for his mother. And all his panic about both the money and the fact that he's graffitied the statue of the Grand Duke, you know, he feels himself to be a country boy, but at the same time the city is grabbing him. All the fun that he's having with these boys. There's a couple of times where the story says that, wow, it almost felt good to have had some money stolen off you. He's almost pleased with the excitement of it. And for me, this is a prose poem. This is now just after they've followed Herr Grundeis to the hotel, the Hotel Kreid in Nollendorf Square. And it's a little lull, really. And in the lull, you can almost hear Kästner wanting to move the plot on, but then he wants to stop and look at Berlin. It was getting dark, and the illuminated signs began to flash on and off. Trains thundered by on the overhead railway. Other trains rumbled beneath them on the underground. The noise in the street of all the passing trams, buses, cars and motorbikes sounded to Emil like some crazy orchestra playing wildly. From a nearby cafe came the strains of dance music, and people were crowding into the cinemas round the square for the last performances. You know, that's as good as any passage anywhere in describing the movement and the feeling of a city. The idea that, you know, there are trains above you and below you, and the fact that they make an orchestra and there is dance music going on in a cafe and roundabout. You've got the street noise, exactly as it says in English. I must look back at the German and see how it's expressed. We've just come out of Friedrichstrasse station, and this has just hit me, quite a surprise really. This is a sculpture that almost matches a sculpture in Liverpool Street Station. On one side is a boy and a girl with a suitcase. The girl's carrying a teddy bear, which of course links with dear Judith Kerr, who came out of Germany at this time, leaving her teddy bear in Berlin. So these two have got out on what we call Kinder Transport. Trains to life, it says over there. Zug in das Leben. And then on the other side we have Zug in den Tod, trains to death. And so here's a group of children again, a suitcase with a broken doll and a violin. And I can see the girl is wearing the star, the Judas star, which my father's uncles had to wear in France, died in Auschwitz. So the worst side of humanity, if you like, happening on this side, and the very best that people were saved on the other side. And it's wonderful to think that that sort of links up with Liverpool Street Station, where there's a wonderful little sculpture, very similar, brass. And as it happens, bringing us back to Emil, the railways are absolutely crucial. At one point he talks about the mass of shiny railway line. And it's exactly what Kästner talks about in the book.
And of course, 1938, so just 9 years after Emil came out. And in the book, obviously there's no inkling, as you have already said, of what was to happen.
Indeed. You know, the book is full of optimism. The city is, you know, it's got its dangers, but they can be overcome. And children are safe. And again, the children talk about, hey, does your mum, is she your dad, is he strict?
And they say, no, if they trust you, it's perfectly all right. We can go out. And they laugh about it. And again, Emil hasn't gone back. He's just in the city. You can't possibly imagine it now that his aunt, she's worried, and the granny is less worried and says, oh, he'll be all right, like that. And there aren't, streams of parents in a state of blind panic. But again and again, it's almost as if Kestner is saying, trust your children, they'll be all right.
That possibly explains also why the book has remained so popular, particularly in Germany, because it is going back to a time of innocence and before these terrible things happened, and Kestner, of course, being untainted by the Nazi era.
What was extraordinary was that Kestner didn't do a Dietrich and a Brecht and a Kurt Weill and Hans Eisler. He stayed. He was true to a German spirit that predated the Third Reich, and then he survived and kept some integrity, particularly, with his pacifist, anti-military standpoint. Maybe, he's somebody that you can save from this wreckage.
So we're on Nollendorf, that's now in Schöneberg, in the south of the city.
They've chased Herr Gondeis all the way to Nollendorfplatz, haven't they? And he's gone into a hotel. They whisk round the back to check that there's no other exits other than the one through the front, and it's the Hotel Kreid, which means chalk. Now, the thing is, what do they do? And they've got a cunning plan. This is the old thing that Brecht says, is that your tank is very good, General, but it has one fault. It has a driver. And a very similar thing that Kestner is saying here. Your systems are absolutely perfect, but there's one fault. We're kids, and inside that hotel is a child, and he's the lift boy, and we have a special way of talking amongst children. It's exactly the same as the Brecht poem. I think it's wonderful. So, of course, Gustav, I think it is, goes in, chats up the boy, and next minute Gustav comes out. He's in a lift boy uniform. They've chatted up the lift boy's dad, and so they can keep an eye on Gondeis. And what do you know, Gondeis has said that he wants to have a wake-up call at 8 o'clock, so they've got him covered. So it's a wonderful scene, really, where the kids have the power. Everything's to play for. Will it happen? Which way will it go? And he suspends you, if you like, in that moment there. Not much of it has survived. I've got an old photograph here, and this is just a little bit to one side of where we are. There's Mottstrasse. What we've got instead is a rather weird sort of white 60s building. Next to it, a casino. And next to that, a very extraordinary art Egypto kind of culture palace of some sort or another that is now...
Yeah, it's a kind of poshed up nightclub. What this used to be, it's the Metropole. It's a former cinema, and it's mentioned in the book. They make reference to the fact that people are spilling out after the last cinema performances. And this is also where the premiere took place of Erich Maria Remarque's All Quiet on the Western Front. And people who were against it, there are reports of how they sent rats into the auditorium to really kick up a fuss about this anti-war film. And, of course, Kestner being a pacifist himself, it all fits in.
Emil and the professor went out and stood in the street by the archway talking about their schools and the masters. The professor pointed out different makes of car as they went by and told Emil how to recognise them. Then they had a sandwich. That's lovely, the business about marks of cars. If I think about my childhood, an enormous amount of it was spent spotting different car makes. This was sort of, the observation. Again and again you find with Kestner is that he is brilliant on tiny detail. And the idea that boys spotting car makes is so boyish, and to think, kids were doing that in the 20s, and of course almost impossible to do in Neustadt, I guess, because, as he points out, they hadn't even motorised the tramway because the mayor was stingy and couldn't be bothered to do it, so they just had a funny old horse and tram, and if you wanted to go quickly, it was better to walk, he says. Entrance hall of the Ellington Hotel, and there's a clear link with Duke Ellington. He played here. There are photographs of him. Now, I've got a link with this place.
My dad often spoke when we were kids about the fact that when he came to Berlin in 46, the first cabaret started up again. Well, about 5 or 6 years ago, I was kind of thinking, well, where was this cabaret? I wonder whether there's any mention of it. And I was going online, and I found as a little commemoration of it, because it's quite famous, because the German playwright Gunther Weisenborn was involved in it, and it seems that Kessner, the writer of the lyrics for cabaret songs, the pair of them, they were writing some of the lyrics for this, and the address is the address of this hotel where we're standing now, the Ellington. Now, it must have been severely damaged in some way or another, because the way my dad described it was that the cabaret went on in the basement, that he went down into a cellar to see it. So it must be underneath where we're standing now.
Doing your thesis, is that right, on Erich Kästner?
Yes, I'm writing my dissertation for my DPhil in German literature about Erich Kästner's prefaces and his afterwords. Erich Kästner was born in Dresden in 1899, and he lived there until 1919. And so after the First World War, he moved to Leipzig, and he studied there. And he lived there until 1927. And he has been a journalist. And he has been thrown out of his newspaper he wrote for, and then he moved to Berlin.
I gather, was he at a party and someone suggested to him that he write a children's book?
He was at a party with Edith Jacobson, and she convinced him to write a children's novel. And he said in some autobiographical text that he wasn't sure if he should do this and about his abilities to do so. But actually, he had a lot of experience before, because he wrote a lot of children's stories before, short stories and poems for newspapers in Leipzig. So he had some experiences, but it was his first larger children's novel.
And we'd like to think in the children's book world that this was really a major innovation in several ways at the same time, particularly the notion of a group of kids acting as detectives. All right, they're not actually cracking the crime, as we say, because they know who did it. It's not a whodunit, but at the same time, they're taking over the job that we normally leave to the police and the detectives. And that it was a pioneer in that respect, but also the kind of freedom that the children take for themselves, the boys take for themselves, and we have to say Pony as well, Pony Hootkin.
I would just add that it's new that it takes place in a big city. So all the other children's books before has been on the countryside, or kind of adventure literature in the Southern Sea or somewhere. And it's not only that it happens in front of the city, they are using the city. I think that refers to the image Kästner had about children, because he saw them as a kind of maybe small adults, a kind of better adults. He took them seriously.
Where did he write the book, Thomas?
Mostly wrote in cafes. He kept this habit until his last days, so he did this as well in Munich.
There is an analogy. J.K. Rowling writing Harry Potter in Crawford's Cafe in Edinburgh, I do believe.
It's quite sad that a preface in the English edition is missing, because we meet a person, a writer, called Herr Kästner in a cafe.
This is in the German...
In the German preface.
The edition.
Yes. And there he mentioned that he actually wanted to write an adventure. And then he struggled a little bit, because he didn't know how many legs a whale had.
he's not able to go further with his story because it has to be realistic. Then the waiter came to him and said, so it's a person from the working class, and said, well, why don't you write about things by whom you are surrounded? And so this is, I think, quite an important point also for his entire concept of literature. So he's an author who concentrates on contemporaries and his surrounding, and that influences him a lot.
One fragment of that, which I've always thought is terribly important, we have these vignettes. We have a picture by Walter Trier,
yeah,
and then underneath it, a little piece of writing, yeah, by Kästner, where sometimes he says, I and you. So though the narration is third person, with no I and you in it, yes, suddenly, yeah, we have Kästner talking to the child who's reading and says, I think this, and you talking to the reader. And I just love the idea that within a book you can have the three voices. You can have the he of the narrator, as we call the omniscient narrator, the narrator, yeah, who can see everything. And then suddenly we have I. Who is I? Well, it's Kästner. And then, lo and behold, a bit later, we have this strange journalist who turns up, slightly mysterious, who, after all, was very kind to Emil on the bus when he was anonymous, and there he is. And it's Kästner again!
It's Kästner. In the German edition, these vignettes are situated in between the preface and the beginning of the novel, so they're not situated in the text. There's not this kind of literary play you mentioned between I and he. And it's interesting that he mentioned in the last lines of his preface that all these ideas came into his mind about Emil. And then he mentioned that there were falling 10 pictures. And he offered the reader, if the reader can rearrange them in the right order and create a kind of story before the story even starts.
Oh, so, my goodness, yeah. This is anticipating Burroughs, it's anticipating cut-ups. I mean, B.S. Johnson, who created a book that was in a box that you had to shuffle the leaves. This is modernism, isn't it?
It is. It's quite modern. That's
fantastic.
True.
Fantastic. One other thing. When the book came out, what was the reception like in Germany?
It was an amazing success, the book. It took just 2 years, then it was produced as a movie, and it was translated in a lot of languages.
Do you know whether there was any response to the book in Germany that disapproved of it in any way, that this is part of decadence of Berlin?
So there has been some persons who said, well, this shouldn't be the kind we want to educate our children. But even the National Socialists didn't forbid it in the first years when Hitler came into power. And I think it's just because it has been such a massive success.
So, Thomas, you've brought us to what looks like a big glass square overlooking what might be a cellar or something.
This is a Bebelplatz. It was called Opernplatz in Kästner's days here in Berlin. And it's the place where the National Socialists burned the books on the 10th of May in 1933. So they brought the books from the libraries of the university to this place and they burned them.
And I've seen a little piece of film, and you can hear the names of authors' books being,
yes,
burnt. And I think the last name in a little list of names, you hear him say, Kästner, like that, very sharp voice.
Yeah.
And he says, Kästner.
Kästner was here, actually, just to mention it, when they burnt his book.
He was right here
in the crowd. And I think he was the only author whose books has been burnt here, who has been present to be a kind of witness to see what's happening, what's going on here. And also Goebbels has been here. 10 students were throwing the books into the flames. I think the reason was against decadence and moral destruction.
They weren't burning Emil, they were burning his pacifist poems.
Yes.
They thought that he was anti-militarist, mm-hmm, and pacifist.
And Fabian, it was a novel by him, Fabian, the story of a moralist. And so this was his first novel for adults.
In Berlin, wie in anderen Universitätsstädten Deutschlands, wurden undeutsche und unsittliche Bücher von den Studenten eingesammelt und öffentlich verbrannt. Reichsminister Dr. Goebbels spricht zur Jugend.
meine Kommilitonen, jung schon den Mut zu haben, dem Leben in die erbarmungslosen Augen hineinzuschauen. Die Furcht vor dem Tode zu verlernen, um vor dem Tode wieder Ehrfurcht zu bekommen. Das ist die Aufgabe.
Michael Rosen there with Kate Connolly. You can find out more about Emil and the Detectives and the Young City Reads on the Brighton Festival website. You don't have to live there to take part in the online conversation. The other half of this German language edition is devoted to a contemporary Swiss German novelist, Rolf Dobelli. He has a PhD in economic philosophy, has worked as a businessman, and is a newspaper and TV columnist. But he had instant success when he published a non-fiction book, The Art of Thinking Clearly. As we're always in search of a little bit of clarity on this podcast, we invited him into The Guardian to set us straight.
It is a collection of systematic thinking errors. And I've listed about 100 systematic thinking errors we always fall prey to in business and in life. And my goal is to show those things, to show these thinking errors so we can avoid them.
What is your background? Why do you have the right to tell us about these things?
Well, I'm not a psychologist, but I became a psychologist by reading so much about these thinking errors. And that is research from the last 30 years. I'm actually a trained economist, I'm a business person, I started businesses, and I'm also a novelist. But 4 years ago, I really wanted to have a checklist for myself that when I make a big decision, I wanted to go through to not fall into a trap. And I started to make notes, and these notes were dispersed to friends. It became a newspaper column in Germany, in Switzerland, in the Netherlands, and then finally to this best-selling book.
Tell us about some of your fallacies. I was particularly interested in the swimmer's body illusion, which I fear I've probably suffered from occasionally in the past.
And it's a story goes like this. My friend Nassim Taleb, who is also a big rider, he wanted to do something for his body. He wanted to feel stronger and have a bit of better body. So he started to train. He looked at all these professional swimmers and said, well, they have beautiful bodies. So I go and train in the pool for 3 or 4 times a week. But then he realized, no, this is a fallacy. They're great swimmers because they have these bodies and not vice versa. They're born with these bodies and that's why they're professional good swimmers and successful swimmers. So it is the other way around. It is actually a selection criteria to success. And it's not about how much you train. In most cases, so it is a selection error in most cases.
And you have lots of linked categories. So that links into quite an interesting chapter about how Harvard may not be the best place to get a degree from. It may be just that it selects the best people.
Exactly. That's exactly the same error. You take a great school like Harvard. You look at the people that come out 10 years, 20 years later. They're hugely successful. Why is this? Now everybody thinks it's Harvard. But it might not be Harvard. It might not be the education. It just might be because Harvard selected these people and they turned out well. Whether the education they received in these 4 years was good or not, it doesn't really matter. It was just a great selection criteria.
And you're a synthesizer, in other words.
Exactly.
Rather than a researcher, which you make that point in your introduction.
Absolutely. I'm not a researcher. I'd love to have funds and create my own lab. But I'm myself just a writer and I'm synthesizing great research that has been done in the last 30 years.
One of your essays, which is very controversial in The Guardian, it is titled Avoid News.
It's actually the last of those 99 chapters in my book is Avoid News, because if you consume news, you make a wrong decision or you actually fall into the traps of taking too much risk on the wrong things. When you consume news, first of all, you walk around with the wrong risk map in your head. Newspapers can only run news stories that are bright, that are sensational, that attract the attention of the reader because they want to sell advertising next to that newspaper article. So everything that doesn't fall into this category gets dropped. Everything that is slow developing, that is abstract, that can't be personalized, that is being dropped. So newspapers tend not to report on that stuff, but they tend to over-report on the bright nature catastrophes, people who die bombs going off, terrorist attacks and these things. So when we look at the world, we have a wrong impression of the risks. We tend to think that terrorism attacks, for example, are much more likely to happen than they actually are.
And you have actually put this belief into practice in your own life, haven't you?
Absolutely. First of all, there are 15 reasons. I just gave you one reason why not to consume news, and I've written them in an essay, and you can download them on www.dobelli.com, on my website, dobelli.com. I've put it into practice. I haven't consumed news for about 4 years. Don't have a newspaper, I don't have radio, I don't have TV, I don't consume news online or on my cell phone. And it's been quite a lifesaver for me because it gave me so much time. It doesn't attract me to the wrong things. And I try to focus on reading books because they can explain the generators of the events. News are like flickering on the surface. These are little things that go off here and there, and here a bomb blew up and here an airplane crashed. But I'd like to understand how the world really works. I'd like to understand the generators of these ideas. And for that, you need bigger content pieces. A small article won't explain the world.
So you're making a particular point here, aren't you, which is, when you talk about news, you're talking about the headline articles, the front page articles, but you do read long form journalism.
Exactly.
It's not that you don't read news in any form at all.
No, you're absolutely correct. I read the long articles. I love long articles, even in newspapers. For example, the New Yorker magazine has beautiful articles. They might not be on the subject of the day. They might be a month late or a year late with their coverage, but they're in-depth. And that's what I love. And then, of course, books, which are a perfect form of conveying the generators of the world.
Which we like to hear on this books podcast. We have had an issue recently about the breakdown of herd immunity for measles, mumps and rubella. There is an epidemic because there was at one point a lot of parents stopped having their children immunised, and now suddenly there is a measles epidemic. And I was wondering whether, as somebody who didn't consume news, you relied on the herd consuming the news in order for you to have any information at all. If everybody was like you, we would be in North Korea, wouldn't we?
No, that's not true. If everybody was like me, the market would generate an offering, a news offering or a content offering that would be fewer pieces, longer pieces, in-depth pieces, and I would be happy to pay for that subscription. So my ideal solution for a media would be, give me a weekly thing with maybe three stories that are really hugely relevant and explain it really in-depth. What happens? And I would be willing to pay for that. Unfortunately, I'm such an exotic person that there's no industry springing up following my demands here.
But this is full of short form pieces. It's 99 very short pieces.
But they're all tied together. These are just 99 expressions of the same underlying problem that we have, that our brain is not made for this world. See, our brain is a biological organ that was made for a hunter and gatherer society, for our ancestors, for our true great 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 fathers and grandmothers. Now this brain, with this hardware and software, is put in this very complex environment where we have financial markets and we have industrialization, globalization, and it just makes systematic errors. And this is just the 99 typical systematic errors that we do.
And part of the structure is the way you interconnect all of the chapters.
Correct.
To each other. You have a sort of running sub-commentary, don't you, which is to say, oh, see chapter such and such.
Yeah, they're all connected because it all happens in the brain, and also in the brain you have areas linked to the others, so they're all connected to each other. You can't just make one mistake but not the other 98 mistakes. We all make all the 99 mistakes. My hope is just to reduce that by maybe 10% or 20%, that we make a little bit better decisions every time, but you can't eradicate these errors completely.
So this is not a self-help book?
No, it's not a self-help book. The difference to a self-help book is the following. Self-help books tell you, do this and this and this, add stuff to your life to become more successful. I say, reduce things, reduce mistakes. See, we don't know what makes us successful, but we know what hinders success, what kills success. And I'm trying to work on that lower part of eliminating errors, and then the upside will take care of itself.
Rolf Dobelli. Dobelli caused a bit of a stir when he came into the Guardian. Dobelli caused a bit of a stir when he came into the Guardian HQ to introduce his ideas to our journalists. He went on to write a guest column about why we should all go into news purdah, as he has done for the last 4 years. Columnist Madeline Bunting wrote a spirited riposte, and she joins me here now in the studio. Madeline, tell us what it was that you took exception to.
It seems to me that there's a sort of strange sense of sort of opting out to retreat into a kind of news purdah like that. We have a kind of shared life, and you can choose to ignore that, or you can accept the responsibilities that I believe it entails. It seems to me fundamental to living in a democratic society and part of sort of citizenship, if you like, that you know what's going on, that you have an informed interest and understanding of some of the big issues. Otherwise, you know, it's a bit odd if you sort of turn around years down the line and say, well, my kid's school was rubbish and the hospital where I ended up in was also rubbish. Well, you know, it's up to everybody to actually collectively ensure that we have the debates that ensure that we have, you know, good schools, good hospitals, and that the country is run effectively. So I think it's part of your sort of democratic responsibility at its most basic.
Part of what you argued was that his area of concern was more the internet than with actual newspapers. Or maybe that's a bit of a defensive position.
Well, the interesting thing is that actually he said he's not in complete news purdah. He has stopped consuming it in the most dominant fashion, i.e. he's not looking at websites and little sort of packaged bites on his mobile phone. What he's doing is reading longer form journalism and books, and then he's relying on his friends, who are probably extremely well-informed. Now, not everybody has the luxury of lots of very well-informed friends. So the whole point about, you know, news websites and newspapers, et cetera, is to ensure that everybody can participate in this debate, not just a sort of little well-connected elite. So my view really is he isn't in news purdah. He's actually been getting his news, you know, perfectly satisfactorily. In fact, he said as much. There's not one story I've missed. I may be a week late on Thatcher's death, but I haven't missed it. Friends have filled me in. So the point seems to me to be that he's making a very important point. And this is where the funny thing is, that I'm, you know, really interested by what I think he is saying, which is that there is something about the habits that we develop with modern technology, mobile phones and the web, which are about a sort of drip-drip, constant stimulation, checking the mobile phone, checking the headlines dozens of times a day for just little bite-sized chunks. Oh, you know, the Boston bomber this, you know, Chinese earthquake that. But it doesn't actually increase our understanding, for example, of the Boston bombing, which is an extraordinarily complex story. So all we're getting is just little bits of, you know, fact. And actually, that is kind of worthless. And I think he makes a really good point, which is that, you know, the way our brains are structured is that our short-term memory is quite limited. Our long-term memory is not limited, but there's a sort of choke point. So if we fill our heads with lots of little bits of information, we actually are not going to be able to retain and absorb much into our long-term memory. And the key thing here is that where does real understanding and insight come from? And that's about focusing and concentration and really being able to retain things in your long-term memory. So I think there's a really important argument he's making here. It's just, it's not about news. It's about how we consume information in such an information-rich age.
In the aftermath of the Boston bombing, one of his arguments comes into rather horrible light, which he says, we think terrorism is much more likely to happen than it is. It's one of the fallacies. This is the sort of neurosis of news consumption, just because we read all about those attacks and actually you're much more likely to be run over in the road outside your house.
Exactly. So we get always a distorted image through the news because it exaggerates the unusual, the extraordinary, the particular, the unique. To be fair, what I've read quite a lot of in the last few days is commentary which points out that gun crime in America kills far, far more people than terrorism. So, you know, I think that within that sort of wide array of kind of comment, you are getting other people who are trying to point this out. But, you know, terrorism, well, you know, that is the whole point. It's about fear. It's about using fear and panic. So the media colludes with the terrorist in a way that is deeply uncomfortable. You know, obviously we carry the Boston bomber, but in some sense we are creating the spectacle which causes such terror.
Now, you also talked about learned helplessness, which I think is a very interesting concept.
Well, this again is where I think Dabelli's got a very interesting point. And I think this is probably an even more complex point for us to think about how to sort of deal with, because he was saying that the drip, drip, drip of sort of relentless news stories, you know, 90% of them are really miserable. It's kind of environmental catastrophe, it's terrible wars in Syria, it's economic recession. Many of these problems are so enormous and so gigantic that the individual just doesn't know really what to do about any of them. And out of that comes a sort of learned helplessness, a kind of sense of fatalism. And I think it's really problematic to know how a news organisation can at the same time stimulate that sense of agency, that actually there are things you can do and there are people's lives you can affect and help and improve. And I think by and large, it's a bit of a generalisation, but by and large, news organisations don't do such a great job on those kinds of inspiring stories as they do on the fear. So news trades on fear.
Can I just bring you back to the bookishness of this book? What slightly disturbed me about it, and it touches on your idea of him belonging to an elite, is that he is arguing against bite-sized information, but he's done 99 bite-sized chapters. Isn't that a bit patronising?
Yeah. I mean, this is where I think there's a certain muddled thinking going on. I mean, I quite liked the sort of style and approach of the book. I mean, it falls into a sort of pop philosophy category. It's a good provocative way of often getting quite complex arguments out into the public domain so that people can talk about them. So I'm not going to be too hard on him, but you know, muddled thinking at various points in De Belli.
Madeline Bunting. I guess you haven't followed De Belli's line or you wouldn't be here listening. If you haven't already, please do tell your reading friends about us. And do subscribe. You can do so from our podcast page at guardian.co.uk/books or via iTunes or SoundCloud. I'm now wondering about taking a weekend break to Berlin. So thanks to Kate Connolly and Mike Rosen for arousing my interest. Thanks also to Rolf De Belli and Madeline Bunting. From me, Claire Armistead, and our producer, Tim Mabey, for now, auf Wiedersehen.
Visit audible.co.uk/guardian audio to choose from a selection of over 60,000 titles. With Audible, you can make more time for books by downloading and listening wherever you are and whatever you're doing.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.